The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. The good news is that no military units of the great powers are warring against anybody as we begin 1975. But the bad news is that 1975 will probably be about the bloodiest year of recent history. It could be that Chile and Peru will find themselves at war with each other. Both nations have been frantically upgrading their armed forces over the last year and have exchanged all types of hate-filled verbal attacks over a border area in dispute since 1881. In Latin America, you're probably going to see a great number of terrorist acts, the possibility of toppling of governments, other sensational kidnappings and the like, which we have seen continually over the past several years, at least 15 or more. In Europe, well, in general, it looks like Europe is peaceful, but then there's always the trouble of Northern Ireland, the bombings in Britain, the terrible economic problems. In its sixth year of trouble in Northern Ireland, there are over 1,150 dead and still little prospect of reaching a lasting peace. In Mali and Upper Volta in Africa, two of Africa's most impoverished nations, there's the threat of war. And the reason is that Mali claims a 100-mile stretch of land in the sub-Sahara now belonging to neighboring Upper Volta. It's suspected to contain rich natural resources such as oil and natural gas and the like, maybe manganese and titanium. And although black African leaders have tried to mediate the dispute, the chances of a full-scale conflict in that area of the world already beset by drought and famine and starvation and the chances of warfare are said to be very high. In Ethiopia, the new military regime is trying to crush a 12-year-old secessionist movement in the strategically important province of Eritrea, with the government vowing to fight to beat back the bandits. In the Philippines, the government is likely to step up its fight against Muslim rebels. In the southern islands, in Burma, they're expected to come under increasing pressure from communist guerrillas exploiting economic and political troubles. And, of course, in Vietnam, that has been happening. It was recently that Giap, who is the North Vietnamese defense minister and chief military strategist, said that prospects for revolution in South Vietnam were enhanced because the United States is undergoing a period of weakness. He told the National Assembly recently, and I quote his words, "Now that the United States is beset with difficulties, its military, economic, and political weakening, its many other troubles at home and abroad, the prospects of the revolution in South Vietnam are very good." And that war, by the way, in South Vietnam, the United States has spent more than $8 billion in military and economic aid to Southeast Asia since the so-called ceasefire agreement on January 28, 1973. And more than $6 billion was for the continuing of the war in Southeast Asia. So that's got to be one of the most expensive ceasefires in all of the world's history, and probably the emptiest and the most meaningless, the most fraudulent one. As a matter of practical fact, last year, 1974, was one, I think it ranked with just one other, perhaps in 72, but one of the absolute bloodiest years in all of the long, protracted history of the Vietnam War. Most people don't seem to realize that, but the so-called peace of Vietnam, with at least American combat troops having been withdrawn, is not peace at all. It took about 75,000 lives. There were about 14,500 South Vietnamese government troops, 57,000 Viet Cong and North Vietnamese, and 7,000 civilians in areas held by the government that died in 1974. And those are official figures, but you could add to that multiple tens of thousands of wounded and injured, and those that are missing and never known truly to be dead. So nearly 2 years after the signing of the agreement that won a Nobel Peace Prize for Secretary of State Henry A. Kissinger, and for North Vietnam's Lee Duc Tho, you may remember, not one of the major provisions of that agreement, which won double Nobel Peace Prizes, not one of the agreements has been implemented. Not a one. And during the time of that so-called ceasefire, that's the funniest term for a full-scale war I've ever heard. You know, one of these days they're going to call murder a pat on the back, and they're going to call maybe an automobile accident just a minor fender bender where, you know, 10 or 20 people get killed. These terms we use, like this demilitarized zone where so many tens of thousands were killed with these military forces waging war back and forth in this demilitarized zone. It doesn't make sense. We're now living under the impression, our news media give us, that there's a ceasefire in Vietnam. What in the world does that mean? Only 75,000 people died, one of the bloodiest years in the war's long history, and not one of the major provisions of the peace agreement, so-called, that won double Nobel Prizes for Kissinger and Lee Duck Tho, yet not a one of them has been implemented. The standard of living has fallen. The possibility of a takeover by North Vietnam in 1975 is infinitely stronger and greater than it has been before. The standard of living has fallen for the second straight year. And President Tu was badly weakened by demonstrations and public accusations of the obvious corruption. There are just too many people that are living too high on the hog as a result of too many billions of American dollars and equipment and material that was poured into Vietnam in those 10 years of American involvement that made it one of the greatest prizes outside of Japan in the entirety of the Orient. Huge deep water ports, tremendous dock facilities, airstrips all over the country. Hospitals, barracks, buildings of all types, concrete and really durable buildings, roadways, everything imaginable of industrialization and mechanization and modernization of that southern part of that Vietnamese peninsula that makes it even more of a prize for the would-be communist revolutionaries from North Vietnam. And it's obvious that it's one of the most corrupt governments on the face of the earth. I mean, that is so easily seen. When I was there and interviewed people on the spot and even talked to American contractors, to American civil service workers, to an American military man or two, it was so obvious that there were so many kickbacks, so many payoffs, so much corruption going on. As I said, so many relatives of people high in government driving so many Cadillacs that it's just entirely impossible to see anything else. So even Tu himself, in speeches recently, indicated he wouldn't seek a third term. And the Viet Cong have continued to declare that as long as Tu remained president, there could be no negotiations to end the war. So as you look at 1975 and you try to assess or appraise, what will 1975 be like? What will it bring? Will it bring peace throughout the world? Will it bring peace in any part of the world? You look at the world in general and then in country after country, and you have to say no. No, the chances are probably far more likely that 1975 is going to be a bloodier year, so far as wars are concerned, almost everywhere, than was 1974. It'll probably be a lot worse in Vietnam. In Cambodia, they're not in much better shape. With the arrival of the dry season in late January, the Khmer insurgents are expected to resume their attacks against the capital of Phnom Penh, or Phnom Penh as they may pronounce it, and the few other major cities that are still controlled by the present government. And there have already been an unbelievable number of people killed in the 5 years that this little publicized war has raged back and forth. Over 500,000 have died. Over 600,000 people have died in Cambodia. And one half of the population of the whole country, of about 7 million, have been made into homeless street waifs and refugees. About a half of the population no longer live in any permanent domicile or dwelling place. About a half of the population are simply just homeless refugees. Well, Asia then will be continued to be ravaged by fighting, even though more than a year has gone by since a couple of leaders got a Nobel Peace Prize for negotiating a ceasefire. That is some of the most hypocritical, pretentious, unbelievable goings on I've ever heard of. When you stop to think of that, really, in perspective, does that make any sense? That people are given on a big platform before leaders of the world are handed a gigantic amount of aplomb and respect, and possibly including even dollars in cash, a money grant, and so on. It's unbelievable. And all of this to achieve peace in an area which has seen the bloodiest fighting in the war's long history. Well, you look at Cyprus. Only a fragile ceasefire separates angry Greek and Turkish people who hate one another. The situation is supposed to be diffused there, but you have to keep in mind that both countries maintain large military forces along their common border, that this was the proof that NATO wouldn't work. It was exposure to the soft underbelly of Europe to a warfare terribly close to the Middle East, always a tinderbox ready to erupt at any moment. So on Cyprus, you can't really look for 1975 to bring a lasting peace. Iraq, well, major trouble could erupt there. There's been a literal 13-year-old civil war between Iraqi government soldiers and dissident Kurds that might lead to far more serious clashes between Iran and Iraq because of Iranian backing for the Kurds. The Middle East, everyone knows, is a time bomb. Now, presently, as we wait to see what Russian leadership is going to do after Brezhnev decided to put off his visit to Cairo, we wait for the outcome of another Cairo summit meeting, an all-Arab conference. We wonder about the price of oil. We wonder about the possibility of military intervention by some nation or another. The charges by Yasser Arafat that the United States was engaging in clandestine desert maneuvers and was even intending to attack into the Middle East with the Israelis to seize oil is, of course, just another lie from fat little Yasser Arafat to match the other lies he has told. But nevertheless, everyone knows that there is going to be trouble in the Middle East. There is just no way out of it. As long as Syria maintains its continual intractable stance, and as long as Egypt does so, as long as all the Arabs unitedly continue to impose the absolutely stifling, unbelievable and unacceptable cost of their most precious export, oil, continue to build up the vast, huge, unbelievable amounts of surpluses over what they pay for their imports, in their balance of payments surpluses in their country, the flow of dollars into those coffers are so vast and so huge, and yet almost daily you hear that the Arabs don't even really know what to do with the money. Just today, before I came on the air, I was reading articles about how many of the Arab states don't really know how to recycle. They lack the expertise, they lack the financial knowledge, they lack the software, as some people call it, of the intelligentsia or the brain trust or the professional people in international finance to know exactly what to do with the money that they're earning. So reinvestment in other Western countries is coming along very slowly. And sometimes with a hitch and a jerk, and sometimes not very, very well done, because they just really haven't made any sound policy about how to recycle some of those dollars. And dollars, as I've made the comment recently about the American economy, are of no value. Money is of no value because it exists. Money is of no good whatsoever to those Arabs in the bank over there somewhere. Money flowing into the country, just paper money, tons, stacks of it, warehouses full of it, barns full of it, whether in gold or silver or dollars or francs or Deutschmarks or Swiss francs or Belgian francs or Dutch guilders or U.S. dollars, I don't care what you call them, it doesn't matter, it is of no value to anybody, they can't do anything with it unless they use it. And if they honestly don't know how to use it, which many of them simply do not, then all it does is to continue to throw the Western economies into economic chaos, while it doesn't really help the Arabs. Now, some of the Arabs have begun to nationalize some of the, that's a polite word for steal, but nationalize some of the so-called exploitation industries, American, Europe, other countries that have gone in there to invest very heavily to develop the natural resources of the Arab oil-rich countries. So some of them have nationalized them. Others are moving toward more mutual sharing so far as buying up more shares or a larger percentage of some of the foreign-owned oil companies. Tiny Kuwait, with its little bitty population and its gigantic surplus in dollars, has decided not to industrialize, but to stay exactly where it is, which is like a medieval, Middle Ages nomadic society of a few desert tribesmen, and is going to try to bank its oil in the ground. Many another Arab country will probably do the same thing, trying to stretch out the projected years of production so as not to exhaust it very quickly and be sitting atop a mountainous pile of money and not know what to do with it. 1975 is going to be quite a year. When you look at the prognosis for the United States, as far as the economy is concerned, and I'm sure many people have been reading their newspapers, looking at the entire chart of the Dow Jones averages for 1974, as I did this morning, and wondering, well, what's going to happen in 75? Everybody pretty much agrees it's going to get a lot worse before it gets a bit better. That it'll be a year divided into about 9 months of deepening recession, followed by a few months that might mark the beginning of a genuine recovery. That's about the most glowing terminology you can find today among financial prognosticators who try to look at the pulse of American business. The upturn might come, they claim, a few months sooner than that if Congress moves fast on cutting income taxes. But have you ever known Congress to move fast on doing anything, especially on cutting taxes? But you know, often swift action might be promised by people who seek seats in Congress, and then Congress seems to get bogged down in arguments and fights, and nothing much gets done. They might have 60 or 100 or 1,000 things to discuss, and they might get through two or three of them. Now, barring some real swift action, which is promised by Congress, but probably won't be delivered, then 1975 will not show any real economic growth in the United States, even though the output of goods and services might climb. In almost every line of activity, the prognosticators claim to see radical change. It means you can expect to see prices climbing far faster than income, in spite of the fact that many different vested interests, and especially the unions, will try to see to it that that is not so by striking for higher wages to keep them going ahead of the rapidly rising cost of living index. They won't do it. They won't succeed, but they'll certainly try. And in a lot of vital areas, it could mean real headaches, especially in vital services where even the country's security might be threatened. Purchasing power is going to fall. You can just about bank on that. Worry, insecurity, fear, a case of nerves about the economy is going to increase, which makes the danger of a deep depression all the greater. One little bright note that we saw in the earlier opening hours of 1975 was that the price of gold slacked off a little bit, and I was so deliriously happy. Really, I applauded. I said, isn't that great? I'm so glad to hear it, because I had done several broadcasts on the stupidity of people speculating who know nothing about it in one of the most dangerous, one of the most volatile commodities that you could ever buy, gold, thinking that it's a hedge, thinking that somehow they're going to stave off some personal financial disaster by having a private little gold hoard. So we have also written in the Plain Truth magazine the many, many dangers inherent in any such move by private citizens, and I was very happy to see that many of the major banks are simply going to refuse to deal in it. Now, if you look underlying the entire move by the government to allow people to buy gold, you see that it's like a feeler. It's like a test of the market. That obviously governments want to move toward reestablishing confidence in currency, and especially the dollar, because, after all, the coffers of the world are filled with so many billions of American printed paper money. It needs to be put back as a reserve currency, and it probably needs to be pinned to something in which people have confidence, which is gold. People just have confidence in gold. Don't ask me or anybody who even deals in it why, but they do. There's some kind of a mysterious mystique that surrounds gold that maybe people don't even understand themselves. So the American government allows people to buy it, testing it on the open market, probably determining eventually exactly what is the confidence level, what's the confidence spread or the range of where people would feel confident, and how many dollars per ounce is it supposed to be, quote, worth, end quote. Once that is determined, you might see some major monetary changes in 1975. You might see some complete, I mean large scale now, I'm talking about vast percentage points, devaluation of the American dollar so that it becomes more competitive abroad. You might find that the American government decides to pin the American dollar to gold, and that it raises the price of gold in dollars per ounce somewhere real close to the $180 or $200 an ounce mark. I don't know for sure. But people who deal in gold are speculating that that may be true. Now, if that happens, the Arabs have promised to retaliate. If that happens, in short, it means that the American government is suddenly, by somewhere around the $42 to $43 an ounce range, closer to the $200 an ounce range, richer in its gold reserves than it was, meaning the dollars are just that much more valuable. We just suddenly got that many more dollars with which to buy Arab oil. So that brings the purchasing power of the dollar way up. It allows us to buy proportionately more oil for the same dollars or the same amount of oil for far fewer dollars, whichever way you want to look at it. The Arabs don't want to sit still for that, so they've said they'll retaliate by one or two or three methods. They'll either simply cut production down to about a third of what it is today, which is kind of like a partial embargo, or maybe they'll simply jack the prices back up to mean exactly proportionate to where it was, meaning instead of four times, it'll be eight times or ten times what it used to be, simply because they want to stay even. They don't know why. They don't need the money. They don't know what to do with the money when they get it. They have no real ideas on how to recycle the money. And if they could recycle the money, they would have to take every major building corporation you could imagine over into the Middle Eastern area. And if they were laboring day and night, month after month after month, to build up and to industrialize, to modernize all of those Arab nations, they couldn't begin to spend the money fast enough. The monies that they have earned in just one short year, the incredible difference between the surplus in the balance of payments by those Arab countries, including all that they can pay off, surplus only I'm talking about now, not just raw dollars, paying off all that they import and what is left over, is so incredible that even given years of some of the major construction companies of the West, they simply wouldn't even know how to spend it. So you need to keep your eyes glued on the Middle East, as I've been saying for so many years on this program. One full third of the Bible is prophecy. And much of Bible prophecy revolves around the Middle East. It revolves directly around Jerusalem. Jerusalem in the Middle East is the area from which Bible prophecy views all the rest of the world. I remind you, the Bible is a Middle Eastern book. It was written from the point of view ethnically, religiously, historically, from the point of view of prophecy, from the area of Jerusalem as it views and looks out toward the rest of the world. It's no wonder, then, that some of the most important prophecies revolve around that area of the earth. That Jesus Christ, in the most important prophecy in the Bible, in Matthew 24, talked about what you see in the area of Jerusalem. He said, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know the desolation thereof is nigh. And the most specific and the technically intricate prophecy of all, in Daniel the 11th chapter, that is one of the most detailed in all the Bible, also ends in the Middle East. In verse 40 of Daniel 11, it talks about a mysterious king of the south. A king of the south that has the power over treasures of gold and of silver. It even mentions the nation of Egypt. It mentions Libya and Ethiopia. Other nations are mentioned by their ancient tribal names, such as Moab, the chief of the children of Ammon. But you know, the capital of Jordan is Amman. And those names are indelibly stamped in those areas. The peoples that they identify are still there. There are several prophecies in the Old Testament that talk about the people of Moab and Ammon, that say that they had settled on their lees, that they had not emigrated, they had not moved. Now, settling on the lee, well, that's a term that is used that wine growers know. It actually has to do with large kegs of wine that settle on the lees and that for many, many years mature to become a fine vintage wine. So the Bible prophecies indicate that those peoples that always dwelt to the east of the Jordan River, in the Negev or the desert areas, to the east of modern-day Palestine, a word that we got from Philistia or the Philistines anciently. It's now known as Israel, and of course Jordan, occupying a part of the same country that was formerly Palestine. But at any rate, those peoples are still there. Now the language that is used in that 11th chapter of Daniel doesn't say this mysterious king of the south goes to war against the king of the north. It describes a pushing match, a shoving, a jostling of some kind. It says, at the time of the end, in verse 40 of Daniel 11, shall the king of the south push at him. It's interesting that King Faisal, as one very important leader, and a little more moderate than some, among the Arab countries of Saudi Arabia today, is himself the self-appointed protector of the holy places of the city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a city that is important from several points of view, not the least of which is religiously, because it is the very cradle or birthplace, you might say, of three of the major religions of the world. The Muslim faith, or Mohammedan as it used to be called, of Islam, the Jewish faith, and of course the so-called Christian faith, divided up into about 400 different major denominations and hundreds of other smaller sects and groups. Now, it is said that the prophet Muhammad went to heaven right there from the site of the Dome of the Rock. It's also said by the Jews that that's the place where Abraham was about to sacrifice Isaac. It's also said, according to Jewish tradition, that that is the site of the ancient Garden of Eden. And in the New Testament, it is said that that very spot, Mount Zion, is the spot where Jesus Christ of Nazareth is going to return. Now, Faisal claims that he is the protector, that he is the overseer of the Arab holy places of the city of Jerusalem. So religiously, as well as economically, and don't ever think for one moment that religion is not one of the most important political inputs in the Middle East, because it is. The religious overtones of the Arab-Jewish struggle are almost always overlooked in the newspaper. You never hear a word about it. There isn't any so-called holy war that is in the making over there. You never read an article about the Syrians or the Egyptians or those who support them, such as the Soviet Union, waging some kind of a war of Islam against the infidel. But don't think for one moment that that is not the underlying antagonism. and it's racial and ethnic, but it's absolutely spiritual and religious in its origins. Now, it says here that at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, meaning the king of the north. Anciently, those were the Ptolemies waging war against the Seleucidae, or the Seleucids, a series of dynasties of kings of Syria of that time. Today it means another king of the north. Who is the northern power that would dare come into that area? As it says here, like a whirlwind, overflowing and passing over, it says, he shall enter into the glorious land, meaning Palestine, meaning Israel, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. So it implies that Iraq, Iran, Jordan, very likely, possibly that includes also the nation of Turkey, that we believe is Esau or Edom, they will all escape. Why? Well, obviously because of political reasons. It must have to do with a difference in government, a difference in alliances, a difference in power blocks, perhaps because of the support of the Soviet Union. Who knows? It's rather vague, but it does say that there will be some kind of a pushing or a shoving match that takes place there, which will bring about literal military intervention in the Middle East. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, plural, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. And he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver. Interesting, isn't it, that possibly even the world's gold and silver is beginning now to flow into Middle Eastern Arab oil-rich hands, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. But, it says, tidings out of the east and out of the north. Now, what is north and east of that area but the massive power of the Soviet Union? Shall trouble him, that's trouble this king of the north. So it shows the king of the north cannot be the Soviet Union, but another king of the north in another area, north of Palestine. And the tidings out of the east and out of the north trouble him. It sounds, in the language used in verse 44 and 45, as if that is the beginning of World War III. Why, then, does Bible prophecy specify, watch Jerusalem, watch Israel, watch the Middle East? Jesus did continually. In Luke 21, Matthew 24, the book of Revelation revolves around that area, the 11th chapter of Daniel, and many prophecies of the Old Testament do. You need to know exactly what to expect in the area of the Middle East. Jesus Christ said to watch you therefore and pray always that you might be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass, which he outlined in Matthew 24 and which you're beginning to see happen around you right now. No, 1975 doesn't look like a year in which we're going to see an economic upturn and peace all over the world. Rather, every prognostication you can read indicates it's going to be one of the bloodiest years of recent history, and it could be, it just could be the year in which Daniel 11, verses 40 and 41 will be fulfilled. Some serious upset in the Middle East. If you want to know ahead of time and to be informed as you can't be by any other publication, be sure to write for the current number of The Plain Truth. And all you need to do is to request it by sending your letter to Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. We need that. That's all. There is no cost, but tell us the name of the radio station to which you've been listening, the call letters, and then send your letter to Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales.